As the anniversary of 9/11 approaches, a lot of people have been looking to see how the attack has affected the language. But according to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, they've been looking in the wrong places.
Over the last few weeks, there's been a spate of articles on the effects that the 9/11 attacks have had on the language. I can see where that would seem an obvious subject. If 9/11 meant that everything was different, then you'd figure we'd be talking differently, too. As a writer in the New York Times put it, the words of 9/11 remain chiseled into the language. But the language isn't really like the Vietnam Memorial. It doesn't permanently record every momentous public event in stone. There are a lot of words that have been more prominent since the attack, some old and some recycled: ground zero, weaponized, sleeper cell, evildoer, homeland security. But apart from 9/11 itself, these are mostly news crawl words that aren't likely to take up permanent residence in our everyday speech. I hear a lot of people using jihad these days, but then a decade or so ago, I was hearing everybody use that mother of all battles formula. The fact is that world events only have a big effect on the language when they transform the daily lives of millions of Americans, the way World War II did. That war made dozens of contributions to our ordinary vocabulary, from beachhead, blockbuster, and bloodbath to firepower, flak, and foxhole. And even the comparatively limited conflict in Vietnam popularized items like hawks and doves, grunt, and boat people, not to mention memorable euphemisms like friendly fire and collateral damage. But I wouldn't look for similar effects from 9/11, or at least not unless we find ourselves in a long and messy ground war in Iraq. The attacks and their aftermath are still weighing on our minds, but people's daily preoccupations have returned to pretty much what they were before. In fact, one post-9/11 phrase that's already disappeared is "That's so September 10th. Or as the ad for Southwest Airlines says, "Business travel is back." And yet the attacks have left some traces in the way we talk, if you look for them in the right places. On a hunch, I went to check how the newspapers were using that problematic word enormity in the months immediately following the attacks. I say problematic because this is one of those words that the usage mavens are always getting shirty about. The traditional rule says that you're only supposed to use enormity to refer to things that are monstrously evil or horrible, like Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes, not just for things of great size, like a 747 or Bill Gates' fortune. Now, in the great debates over usage, I tend to side with the noncombatants. But I confess that it still bothers me to hear enormity used as a synonym for huge. For a long time, I used to do an inward double take when I saw somebody referring to the enormity of Joe DiMaggio's impact on the game of baseball. I mean, that's something I wouldn't even say about George Steinbrenner. But at a certain point, it struck me that all those double takes were probably giving me a stiff neck. Back in 2000, I looked at 100 citations for enormity from a database of major newspapers and found that only about a third of them actually used the word to refer to horrible or monstrous things. When the tide is going that much against you on a question of usage, it's usually a good idea to abandon ship. Even William Safire has thrown in the towel on enormity. But it turns out that the old sense of enormity made a big comeback in the 3 months after 9/11. The word was 5 times as frequent as it was in the previous 3 months, and writers were using it correctly 80% of the time, particularly when they were talking about the attacks. That makes sense to me. In the weeks right after the attacks, people were groping for words to do justice to their anger and shock. A lot of politicians and journalists were using language that suggested an almost Victorian sense of indignation: despicable, dastardly, nefarious. But it turned out that the word that conveyed the exact mix of outrage and wickedness and horror was sitting right at hand all along, even if people had half forgotten that it was there. It was like suddenly needing a pie plate you hadn't seen in years, then remembering you'd been using it under a potted plant. And the revival of enormity hasn't shown any signs of fading since then. When I looked at press stories from this summer, writers were still using the word correctly about 2/3 of the time, even in connection with things that have nothing to do with 9/11, like the AIDS crisis in Africa or the wave of child kidnappings. For a moment at least, the attack seemed to have reawakened people's sense of what enormity really means, or I should probably say, what enormity really is. My first instinct would be to say that this won't last. Sooner or later, enormity will go back to being a word that people use mostly to describe things like baseball stadiums. But then I recall how an attack on the U.S. more than 60 years ago breathed new life into another moribund word, infamy. Maybe we should measure the effects of an event not by the new words it introduces, but by the old ones it reminds us to use more carefully.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now.